Accession number 28735, Reel 6.
Rickman, Reel 6. How did you get to Canada?
We were sent on leave to start with, and we had to meet back at a railway station somewhere or other. It was near Manchester.
I think
it was a place called Wilmslow. And that was a... can't think of the word there. Troops were sent there just en masse. They didn't do anything there. They just waited to be transported somewhere else. And we were put on a train at Wilmslow, and it headed up north towards Scotland. And finally it came to Gourock on the Clyde, and we dismounted and looked around. I don't think it was night time. I think we wouldn't have seen anything. No. On the far side of the Clyde we could see a ship, a liner, but it was all painted grey, and it was difficult to discern very much, and it was probably getting on for half a mile away. And someone said, "God, that's a QE1, Queen Elizabeth I, a new liner, only recently been launched just before the war." Someone said, "No, don't be stupid, look at that, it's much too small." Oh well. Anyway, we boarded some pinnace or boat or other, and were driven across to this grey shape. And as we started to get closer to it, of course, it got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And eventually we were looking up the side of it, and it was about 50 feet up to the deck. It was the QE1. So we climbed out of our little boat and onto the companionway up the side, and went to the top. We were, of course, still just the sailors, you understand, and bell-bottom trousers, overcoat and kit bag. And, when we got to the top, I don't think we saluted, because it wasn't a Royal Naval vessel. So we just stood there, and the officer of the watch was standing there. And to my comment that most of the people who were waiting to get on board this boat were RAF personnel, being taken over to Canada for training. And when we came up the companionway in our dark blue uniforms, the officer standing there said, "Ah, sailors, good, I got some work for you fellas." And we thought, what the bloody hell are you talking about? What do you mean work? Yeah. However, yeah, we were taken down and we were shown our cabin, our berth and so on, wherever it was. We didn't have hammocks. I had enough berths to go round. And there must have been 1,000 RAF chaps and about 30 of us. And the work was issued next day. We did lots of exercise, PE, and running around the decks and so on when spare time. But the work we had to do was to man doors between compartments which have clips. And if the ship is hit by a torpedo, then the chap in charge there puts all the clips on. And just over there, and the next chap is putting a clip on the next door, so you're enclosing yourself in a watertight compartment, and you may go down with it. But that's how a ship stays without getting water everywhere. You've got to shut these internal doors, you see. Now, it took 5 days to get from Gourock to New York, which is where we were heading. We didn't know that, but guessed it. And from the second day onwards, apart from getting on board and stowing our gear and being told what the sort of arrangements were for tomorrow, so many of us would be required to go and do the man the watertight doors. I was down for the first 3 days, I think. Yeah. Now you see, because of the number of decks, it was only the decks below the waterline that needed to be manned, and so there were quite a number of them. But the ones that were well below the waterline were just above the engine room, which is the lowest deck there is. There is an all-lock deck underneath that, but that's not used in the normal naval way, except for ballasting or whatever. So the further you go down in the Curie One, the hotter and the greasier it gets, because you're getting closer to the engine room itself, which is diesel. And wouldn't have applied on coal-burning ships, you see, but oil-burning, terribly oily. So I get down and I'm told, petty officer comes along with me and says, right, acting leading airman Rickman, that's your spot, you stay there, and there's your door and there's your clips, and if the hooter goes, put the clips on and stay where you are. 4 hours. 4 hours on, 4 hours off throughout the day. Well, we were one deck above the engine room. It was hot, it was greasy smelling. My stomach started churning and wondering what the hell. You couldn't see, there was no window, we were well below waterline. I was just lying, no point in standing up all the time. You sit down, lie down. I lay down on my side and I was seasick. But I had stayed there for 4 hours. So whether I was seasick 20 times during that time, but mind you, after you've been seasick twice, you've got nothing to bring up, and you just sit there, lie there, reaching your guts out, you see. But you've got to do your duty, you stay there in case a torpedo hits the ship. And that lasted 3 days. So I was 3 days, been seasick all day. Not much fun, I tell you. I don't think, I can't remember whether we did night duty as well. But we probably did, somebody had to. So, this is why the friend of the chap had seen us as dressed as sailors. That's what he was thinking of. You know, that's a typical job. They could have given it to RAF chaps, of course, naturally, but sailors are the obvious people that one might think. So I arrived at New York not seasick, because it took 5 days. The fourth day I wasn't sick, and that was the end of my seasickness for the war. The first 3 days got me so used to it, whatever happened after that I could take, and did. I was never seasick again, not till after the war. And then we at New York, we didn't see much of Grand Central Station, because we were on some siding or other different line, and we were just transferred to a different train. And that train, I think, took 2.5 days to take us to our destination. We went north right the way up through Massachusetts, Vermont. The odd stop where we could nip out and get ice cream or something at some stations. One or two stops, but the engine was taking on water, I'm not sure, probably. But not for long. When I say stop, I'm talking about half an hour. And then we went up and eventually got to Montreal. And there we... The train didn't, it stopped a bit longer, but then it went on again. Eventually we landed up on the north shore of Lake Ontario, which is at an aerodrome called Kingston, or a town called Kingston, Ontario. And that was our 31, I think it was, secondary flying training school on Harvard's.
What was the
start of a Canadian winter? It was summer actually, when we went out there, the end of summer. Sun was shining, and for the first two or three weeks, I think, we were playing tennis on tennis courts, you know, around the camp.
What was the station like, and how did it differ from Elmden? Was there a big contrast, or was it more similar?
Oh no, it's a big contrast to what we've had before in various ways. You see, at Tiger Moss at Elmden, I don't suppose there were more than 10 flying at any one time. There were only 30 of us on course, you see. And so you all got a go during the day, provided it was flyable. Of course, rainy days, low clouds and so on. Sorry, fellas, no flying. Got to sit around and have coffee and eat buns and talk navigation or meteorology or, you know, other aspects suitable for young pilots to learn. But we can hardly believe this. I think it had a triangle of runways, did Kingston, and we were housed in big dormitories. I think they were three-story buildings, if not four, great big box barn-like shapes, and in the dormitories, again, double bunks, one below, one up, one below, one up. Probably 40 or 50 to a dormitory. Now, what we didn't realise and soon found out was the fact that that station had 100 Harvards on it, and it was flying 24 hours a day. And what we didn't know about the Harvard, and we soon learned, it has a fixed pitch propeller. In other words, the propeller is set into its mounting, and the propeller itself cannot be twisted in pitch, coarse pitch or fine pitch. It's constant pitch. The effect of that when it's at full power is that as the Harvard starts to come towards you, you hear a fairly raucous buzz noise. But as it gets closer and closer, where the plane of the air disturbed by the propeller in its rotation, when that is exactly opposite you, it is almost at the speed of sound. So the roar from this speed of sound, 663 miles per hour at ground level, I think that's about what it's supposed to be, it's an ear-shattering roar as it goes and goes past you. Now, you see, these dormitories of ours were 50 yards from the runway. And so, lights out at 10 o'clock, and from then on, of course, there was a thundering roar 50 feet above your head. The night flying pilots of other courses, there are about four or five courses going through gradually all the time, as one left, another one joined, and so on. These Harvards were taking off over the top of the dormitories, and we didn't get any sleep for four nights. But again, like the seasickness, the next night it died. I wouldn't have believed it. I wouldn't have thought. If anyone said, it suddenly, we didn't hear the Harvards, I said, of course you did, of course you did. You must have did. You couldn't ignore it. But your body did, and your brain did. And so we slept perfectly well after that. The Harvard, of course, looking, I've got a picture of the Harvard cockpit, and compared with this Tiger Moth, it was more than double in dials. A stronger, all metal aeroplane, heavier, just not quite as easy and sensitive to fly, but much more rugged and stronger. And to some extent, it was just a matter of flying with the instructor, of course. Again, you in the front and him behind. Went through precisely the same set of aero manoeuvres, the takeoff, the turn, the climbing turn, the stall, the spin, the roll, all the normal movements that aircraft have to make and you have to learn to master as soon as you possibly can. And consequently, although my instructor was not that pleased with me to start with, because I had to fight my way down, as he called it, once I had learned how to land at Harvard, I had no problem at all.
What was that you were having a problem with? Did you say fighting it down? What was your problem as you perceived it to be?
It's very difficult to say, actually. I can only say, I suppose, that I was trying to fly it as I would have flown the Tiger Moth. The degree of movement of the controls is what I'm talking about, and the timing of those movements, when you move the stick back slightly, when you kick on a bit of rudder, and how hard you do it at the time or gently and so on. It's the degree of control over those stick, rudder bar, throttle, the combination of all those three things have to take place when you land. And I suppose the throttle I found more difficult in some ways to judge as to what it ought to be. And the trouble with a monoplane, we'll bear in mind at Harvard, a low-wing monoplane, monoplanes do not stall like biplanes do. We talked yesterday, didn't we, about the biplane stalling and just dropping its nose very politely and gently. Well, with a monoplane, if you stall with that, one wing suddenly drops and can drop down all 50 degrees. You can be sort of halfway or more to upside down, you know. Consequently, if you're trying to come into land and you're 4 or 5 feet off the ground, you're nearly down, and you suddenly stall, that wing will suddenly go down. Now, the way to pick it up is to kick on opposite rudder. Now, depending on whether you are sharp on kicking on that rudder and keeping that wing from touching the ground will depend on your ability to land Harvard well. On every flight, as far as I can remember, the system was, if there was anything damaged or wrong with the aircraft, when you climbed out of the aeroplane at the end, you had to report it to the squadron office. Any defect or whatever. I had no reason to do that on the Harvard until one morning I was called into the squadron office and the flight commander said, you were flying Harvard so-and-so yesterday. I'm doing circuits and bumps. Any trouble? I said, no. I do remember on one occasion the wing did drop down a long way, but it didn't touch the ground. I didn't feel anything. He paused and looked at me again and said, come and look at this. And took me outside, and there was my Harvard. The wing tip, the very end of the wing, had just brushed the ground. There was a little patch about 1 inch of shiny aluminium, as it were, and it had just touched the ground fractionally. I hadn't felt it, so I thought when I kicked on the rudder and lifted that wing that I was all right, not knowing that I'd actually damaged the aircraft. It's just like nail varnish, you know, taking the nail varnish off a woman's fingernail. The reason being, as I said, that the monoplane doesn't behave in the same way, and it's unpredictable which wing will drop. You don't know which wing. It could be either, you see. And I'll have more to say about that on another occasion.
When you were training on this, you said obviously it was the same kind of pattern of training with the instructor to start.
Yes, yeah.
Was there more of a period there, though, where you would fly solo during that period as well? Would it be divided up between flights with instructors and flights going solo to do, as you say, circuits and bumps or that sort of thing?
very similar, really, because obviously flying as such, as distinct from fighting, flying the aeroplane under all normal or unusual conditions is the same. You have to learn that regardless of the type of aircraft you're on. And it varies, of course, because aircraft vary in their characteristics. But the one thing that we did do, which was different from the Tiger Moth, of course, was that eventually, once we had done all the flying characteristics that there were and learnt to do those well enough, we had to do gunnery, air gunnery, and bombing. And we were given small smoke bombs, which were fitted, and we were given some uninhabited part of the countryside some miles away from the aerodrome, and there was a sort of I think it was a sort of platform about as big as a square for a 4-foot table, with a sort of wooden cross, plain white, in the middle of a field somewhere. And that was your target, and you would dive down on that and let your smoke bomb go. And there'd be somebody sitting in a hut over there watching to see how close you've got, you see. And we were nearly all 55 or 600 yards away, of course, to start with, nowhere near. But it's not an easy business. Flying yourself is difficult enough when you're learning, let alone throwing darts while you're doing it, as it were, which is what the bombing was like.
With that, was what was the technique for doing it? Because I take it you didn't have a bomb sight or anything of that nature.
No.
What is the technique to aim to do that sort of training period?
I can't remember. It must have been a button on the stick, I would think, just pressing a button and the way it went with on.
What kind of angle of approach would you have, though, to the target?
You'd be diving, I would think, at about 45 to 50 degrees, sort of semi-vertically, yeah. Later on, we found that the only way to be really accurate is to bomb vertically, like the Stukas used to do, straight down. Straightly go down, of course, the more chance there is that where you're pointing at is where the bomb's going to go. But this way, of course, it could be anywhere, you know. So, I don't remember seeing the results of any other of the other squadron members, so I've got nothing with which to compare my own prowess. All I know was that a number of yards that my bombs missed was registered in my logbook, I think, and it was not impressive.
Can you tell me about the gunnery practice that you did?
Gunnery? No. I'm not sure I was right in saying gunnery when I said to the extras.
Would it have been with a drogue, maybe, or something like that?
No, it certainly wasn't with a drogue, no. And I don't suppose it was at the ground target. I must have included that one wrongly, I think. Let's have a little look in the logbook. I'm quoting from my logbook here. On March the 4th, I did 3 flights, FXGP, whatever that is. That would be the initials of some exercise or other, camera gun. And in brackets it says pass. So I was fairly good enough. Second flight, same aircraft, later on. These are 1 hour flights, near enough, so it must have been at a target some way away from the aerodrome itself. And a FXGP camera gun pass. The third flight that day, different aircraft, Sergeant Watson, the instructor, I'm flying those students, aerobatics and spinning, 35 minutes. So I certainly did a number of camera gun attacks on something or other and managed fairly well. But when it came to the last entry on that page is March the 13th for what was called low dive bombing and anti-submarine depth charge attack. 8 bombs I had. Average error 60 yards. Fail.
Did you? I take it as well that you did cross countries during this period.
Yes, yes, yeah.
How did they differ in Canada from the ones that you'd flown in the UK?
Well, now, how would you think if all the landscape is white? Except that it wasn't always white, because of course, a lot of it was forest. Therefore, even a sideways view, although there was some snow on the trees, the trees tended to look black, and the ground looked white. So you'd only got two colours to deal with. Being in the territory of Ontario, which is largely agricultural, not many towns or villages, and so there were very few characteristics. So, and the cross countries, of course, tended to be much longer and larger than the ones that we'd done when we were at Elmden, which were little local ones, you know, flying, say, 50 miles total, whereas out there we were doing 200 miles, I dare say, you know, this lake, fly to that lake and this town and so on, back to base, yeah. That sort of thing.
Would you navigate then by really lakes and railways and that sort of things in Ontario? Because obviously there wouldn't be the same amount of towns, would there?
You're talking cross country still? I don't remember being one being any different from another. I don't remember really what landmarks, if anything, there were. Obviously, lakes you can you think you can see, except that of course, even the lakes froze over in a Canadian winter. I'm talking minus 30, minus 40, and if you're up a few thousand feet, maybe more like minus 50. But the Harvard had a heater, which was most useful, just like a car does, you know. And consequently, you were comfortable enough, except that, as I said, for cross-country work, it was just a matter of identifying lakes and forests. I think they were, the odd town was helpful. But really, it was a different landscape altogether from what I'd experienced in England, with so many fields and roads and railways. These didn't exist there. I mean, there were roads, but they were covered in snow. So you couldn't see them.
Were there any problems caused by flying in winter?
Any?
Problems caused by flying in these wintry conditions?
No, not... Well, I say no. One of the things, sort of cross country I had to do was solo, to take a Harvard west along the coast of Lake Ontario towards Toronto, which was about 100 miles away to the west. And on the way there, there was a little ordinary sized airfield called Trenton. And one was supposed to fly to Trenton, report to the control tower, you know, i.e. stop the airplane, get out, go up and report personally, and then go back in again and turn around and fly back again. Now, when I did my cross country, of course, it was pretty well white all the way. There were hardly any recognition points worth making, but I knew that Trenton was on the coast, as Kingston was, so I just got to follow. You think it might be easy to see the difference between where the land ended and where the lake began. That wasn't true, because the lake also was frozen and covered in snow, and sometimes you couldn't tell the difference. Yeah. So I got to Trenton, and ahead of me was an Anson, the bigger twin-engine British aircraft. And I thought, oh, I looked at the aerodrome, it was all white. There weren't any dark runways. You couldn't tell where to land or not. So I thought, well, if I go a bit behind the Anson, some distance behind him, I'll see where he lands, and if he can land there, I can land there, I reckon. So I did. So the Anson landed, taxied away. I came in 200 or 300 yards behind him, landed what I thought was exactly the same area, and I thought, yeah, I've got to do a nice 3-point landing to impress the control tower, who'll be watching out for me, you know. And I did, and I hardly feel the plane come down at all, and it cruised down slowly, and then it came to a rest, and suddenly it went up on its nose and the propeller bent and the engine stopped and then it dropped back on its tail again. I landed in 6 feet of snow.